You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret today. And on election night, the state of Florida had conclusive election results, while states like Arizona and Nevada still counting them up. And we've heard over and over again, vote counting can take time. Be patient. We want to get this right, which makes sense. While different states have different laws that end up causing them to count votes at different speeds, the wait times also give people, politicians especially, an opening to question what's going on, to sow doubt in the process. But we want to start in Florida, which some see now as the gold standard in voting and vote counting. It took a look in the mirror after a much less smooth election 22 years ago. So what questions do you have about how vote counting works in Florida versus Wisconsin and other states? Join our conversation, 1-800-642-1234, or email us ideas@WPR.org. Our guest is Cord Byrd. He's the Florida State Secretary of State and was a Florida State Representative for 6 years prior to that. Secretary Byrd, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you, Lee. It's great to be with you.
Yeah, take us back 22 years up to the Tuesday night. Paint a picture for us. What were some of the issues that caused problems back in 2000 and how Florida addressed those to be what some are considering the gold standard today?
Sure. So I actually spent election day in 2000 in Palm Beach County watching voting take place and still have my sample butterfly ballot from 22 years ago. And we had a hodgepodge of laws at the time, and supervisors of elections in the different counties. They had different machines and different standards for counting the votes. And so over the last 20 years, Florida has obviously, because of that, quite frankly, embarrassing experience in 2000, made a consistent and concerted effort to improve our elections and to wind up where we are today, which is we get results quickly and efficiently on election night.
So what are some of those big changes from your perspective, Secretary Byrd?
Sure. So in Florida, we have three options for voting. So we have vote by mail, early voting, and then obviously election day. But our results, the counties can begin canvassing, meaning counting the vote by mail and early votes in the 2 weeks leading up to election day. So on election night, that first number that gets reported once our polls close is the vote by mail and early voting. So on election night, all we have to count are the election day results. And I think that's really, really important and has increased the confidence in Florida's elections. And I think that's probably the most important thing that we've done.
Were there arguments in opposition to counting ballots before polls closed on election day, Secretary Byrd?
There's always, when anytime you change election laws, there's always concern. But I think the proof is in the pudding and the results that we have, that it is the right thing to do. And we have very stringent laws and penalties if someone were to release results prior to election night. And that hasn't happened. And the supervisors take their job very seriously. I visited all 67 supervisors of election in their home county after I was appointed in May of this year, to visit with them, to see what security measures they have in place, to meet with their staff. And they all take their job very seriously, and they're all professionals. And we haven't had an issue with counting votes before election day.
Some of the arguments we're hearing out west as votes continue to be tabulated are that they want to make sure they verify every signature and every voter is valid. Is that an issue for you in Florida?
It is not. So on our vote by mail ballots, those have to be in by 7 p.m. on election night. So any vote by mail ballots received after that do not get counted. And on election night, so those votes, vote by mail ballots can continue to come in. But we have deadlines built into our statutes when the supervisors are to complete that process. So I know we had we were still receiving reports as late as 3:30 a.m., but those were just a handful of ballots that were left to be counted. The vast majority of the 7.7 million had already been tabulated.
Cord Byrd, our guest. He is Florida's Secretary of State, joining us live this afternoon. And you can join us at 1-800-642-1234. And Secretary Byrd, how valuable is it to you politically, democratically, in any aspect to have election results quickly?
I think it instills confidence in the voters, and whether you're a Republican or Democrat in Florida or independent, Knowing the results on election night is just been, I think, very comforting to voters. And the longer it takes, the more distrust builds in. I think your lead into the discussion here was spot on, that politicians then begin to sow doubt, they start to question, the media starts to question, and then voters start to question. And I just really don't understand why states can't follow the Florida model. We had more voters vote on Tuesday than Nevada has total population. We had twice as many as Arizona has. There really is no reason for states not to be able to get it done on election night.
So what would your advice be to them, Secretary Byrd?
They can come talk to me. They can come talk to our legislature. Our laws are you can find them online. I think that if they follow what we're doing, because it is the right way to go, as far as the way we count ballots and the security measures we have in place and the openness. I mean, we have a very open process where citizens get to observe the testing of the machines prior to the election. They can observe the canvassing process all the way through. They get to observe signature verification. So while we have strict laws in place, we also give the public the opportunity to witness this entire process, which once again instills confidence.
Was it a big lift to get voters on board with the changes that have taken place since 2000? How much time did it take?
So it is a continual process. And then, we received some criticism. I was in the legislature the past, 6 years. And, anytime we change election laws, especially after a successful election, like in 2020, people say, well, if we had a great election, why did you need to change? Well, we're always looking to strike the right balance between access and integrity. And so while we look at the things we did right, we find other things that we can improve upon. Like the drop boxes, we had a much more lenient drop box law, and then the governor and the legislature decided that we were going to tighten that up because voters do like them, but we needed added security. So it's always just striking, trying to find that right balance of access and integrity.
So with that in mind, Secretary Byrd, what do you think Florida could improve on as we look towards 2024?
Sure. So I think, looking at the with vote by mail, which is a popular method of voting for people in Florida, looking to tighten up the security. Some still question just the signature match. And so we're looking at different options, whether it's another security sleeve on the envelope or putting some type of identification number on the ballot to ensure that that the person who's casting that vote by mail ballot is the person that is the voter.
But you don't have any doubt about the verification that the state of Florida has gone through in verifying, verifying the election results?
No, I have no. We have no question on our certification, and don't see any reason why we wouldn't certify our election results. We have a good process in place that, like I said, is transparent and accurate.
And people seem to be confident about. So, Secretary Byrd, I thank you so much for sharing it with us this afternoon.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to tell you about Florida's success story and help any other states that are looking to maybe change their laws.
You bet. And we're going to focus on Wisconsin next. Cord Byrd is Florida's Secretary of State. And we're going to hear from Wisconsin's former longtime chief election official, Kevin Kennedy, about how things work a little differently when it comes to counting votes here. And a few other states without outstanding votes still rolling in as we speak. Still time for your calls, though, at 1-800-642-1234. What questions would you have about Wisconsin's voting procedures, laws, and when we tabulate the votes? As I understand it, those mail-in or absentee ballots do not start getting counted until after the polls closed. And that, to some degree, created a vacuum or a void following the 2020 election, especially with votes coming in from Milwaukee and particularly. So if you've got questions for our guest, Kevin Kennedy, he is next, and you can join us at 1-800-642-1234. This is Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret. And we continue our talk about what accounts for the differences in vote counting across different states. And joining us now, Madison native Kevin Kennedy, who served as Wisconsin's chief election official from 1983 to 2016. He is former director and general counsel of the Wisconsin Government Accountability Board and currently sits on several boards, including the Center for Election Innovation and Research. Kevin, welcome back to Central Time.
It's great to be back. Thank you, Lee.
Yeah, and you heard the our conversation with Florida Secretary of State Cord Byrd. What were some of your thoughts while you were listening?
Well, I thought that he did an excellent job of describing the process in Florida, pointing out their strengths and why they have their results so quickly. Although I would point out that Florida and Wisconsin's results, the unofficial results that were available for the public, pretty much lined up at the same time, even though we have a different approach.
Yeah,
we knew what 99% of the vote was in Wisconsin by early Wednesday morning.
But that wasn't necessarily the case just a couple of years ago, and that vacuum led for some speculation and theories to roll in. So did Wisconsin change anything for counting ballots between 2020 and 2022?
They did not change anything in terms of counting the ballots. They made it harder to vote in terms of that. And we saw some challenges in that aspect. But the counting process was the same. I think there might have been more focus in Milwaukee. Obviously, 2020, there were many more absentee ballots to count than there was in 2022. That was one big difference. But it was something that experts in the process and the media, in fact, I participated in a media briefing early on saying you can expect that the results from Milwaukee will come in late in 2020 because under Wisconsin law, they can't start processing those in terms of opening them up and putting them into the tabulators to be counted until 7 o'clock on election day.
And why is that?
Well, it's a recognition, I think, I'm not sure there's a strong policy from it as much as it's the way things have been done. Wisconsin doesn't have an early voting process. Everything is absentee. So when you cast a vote before election day, you complete your ballot in front of a witness. If you're doing it in person in the clerk's office, the clerk employee is going to be your witness. And that ballot is going to be sealed and not open till election day. And that's really the biggest delay period. In places like Florida, one with true early voting, the voter goes in just like they would on election day, mark their ballot, place it into a tabulator, and they secure that so that the results aren't released. The secretary made a good point of that. But they also process their absentee by mail ballots as well. So when they come into the clerk's office, they do the checks that would be done at the polling place. In Wisconsin, maybe there's the benefit that it's double checked once in the office and again at the polling place. But in Florida, once it's checked, then the ballots are fed into the machine. So again, once they're unsealed, those results can be displayed just like we do on election night once all the ballots have gotten through.
Kevin,
again, the delay in Wisconsin just tends to be what's the size of the absentee ballot load?
Kevin Kennedy, our guest, he served as Wisconsin's chief election official from 1983 to 2016. And let's go from Florida all the way to Arizona now. And while we try to assure people that voting takes time in places where it's designed to take time is a good and accurate thing, that time still creates space for some bad actors to question the election's legitimacy. And we saw this in 2020, and we're seeing it again now, including from the Republican candidate for Arizona Governor, Carrie Lake, who called election workers there incompetent and accused them of intentionally slowing the results. CNN's Wolf Blitzer asked Maricopa County Board of Supervisors Chairman Bill Gates to respond to that, and here's what he had to say.
It's really sad to hear that we have the Republican nominee for governor here in Arizona who's talking like that. I think, you know, the votes that were just released, 78,000, that doesn't happen magically. It happens because of the people behind me, all the people here in Maricopa County elections who are working so hard. They're working 14 to 18 hour days every day. We're about to go into a holiday weekend with Veterans Day, and they're going to continue to work those kind of hours on the holiday Friday, on Saturday and Sunday. And I understand that Kerry Lake wants us to move quickly, and a lot of people do. But you know what's more important is that this is done accurately. That is the focus. And that, you know, like for all of these mail-in ballots, that those are signature verified. This is very important to me as an elected official, that only eligible people, only eligible votes are counted. I would think that Kerry Lake would be interested in that as well. That's something that I ran on the Board of Supervisors. I support ID at the polls. And all those things, they might take a little bit more time.
Kevin Kennedy, as a former Wisconsin election, a chief election official, what are your thoughts about what Bill Gates had to say to Kerry Lake?
Well, I think he was spot on in defending the integrity of their system. We saw that the 2020 results stood up to, you know, the very poorly conducted audit that was done post-election by a private group of individuals hired by the legislature to do that. But, you know, the delays in Arizona differ from Wisconsin and Florida because they have different rules. They don't start their signature verification, which is a very tedious process, until election day or the day after. And that's really where the delays are. There's a lot of attention paid to make sure that integrity is done. In Wisconsin, you know, we get an ID check before the ballot goes out. We check to make sure that it's witnessed by an individual when it comes in and that witness fully complies. It's checked again at the polling place before it is processed. But we get that checked on election day. And the biggest delay are in the municipalities that don't do it at the polling place. I personally was in charge of a polling place in Madison on election day, and we had 350 absentee ballots that we processed. And I was concerned going into the election whether we'd get that done during the day, but we had them all processed and into the tabulator before 6 o'clock at night, so that when we wrapped up the voting at 8 and transmitted the results to the county clerk, all the absentee totals were in there as well.
Let's go to your calls now at 1-800-642-1234 for our guest, Kevin Kennedy. Heidi in Martin, you're on Central Time.
Hello.
Hi.
I really had a concern about what the gentleman from Florida said when he said they were going to put numbers on the ballots when they mailed them out to verify that that person's number matched the name. Then our ballots are no longer private. Everybody knows how we voted, and that concerns me as a United States citizen.
Heidi, thank you. Aren't ballots numbered, though, Kevin Kennedy? And does that mean that our vote, who we vote for, can be accounted for?
No, our ballots are not numbered. And even in Florida, I think they're trying to adopt the Georgia model. There are some problems with the numbering, not so much because it's tied to the ballot, because the number's not on the ballot. It's on the transmittal envelope. It's no different than having your name on it. The real problem with the numbers, as you're balancing the policy interests, are it's pretty easy to make a mistake copying a 16-digit driver's license number onto that, and you want to make sure that it's set up so not that it's going to be tied to the ballot, but that other people can't see that number, because that's number that we normally are going to keep from public display. But it's not written on the ballot. It's written on the envelope in which the ballot is contained, and they are separated before they're processed. And when you're looking at ballots after the election, you can't tie the ballot to the envelope. The check-in is done ahead of time. I think it's a very good concern that Heidi raises, but it has been addressed. There are some other challenges with using an identifying number versus a witness or a signature verification, or even the ID requirement just to get the ballot.
Heidi, thank you for that call and bringing that to light. And Kevin Kennedy, from your perspective and your work as Wisconsin's former chief election official, as a member of the board of the Center for Election Innovation and Research, what should Wisconsin do to improve its elections?
Well, two things. When it comes to processing the absentee ballots, I think we can look to other states that are processing ballots that are received before Election Day. There, we can keep them the results secure. There's been a strong effort to try and get to allow municipalities to do that. Again, even in Milwaukee, we still had all of the results tabulated. It was late in the morning on the day after the election in 2018 and 2020 and even in 2022, but we weren't 2 days, 1 week, or 2 weeks out like we're seeing in some of the West Coast states on that. The other thing is, you know, it's unfortunate, but there's really been an effort to make it more challenging to vote. The elimination of the drop boxes. You know, there are processes to ensure that they are secure. And it is a convenience that is very helpful to voters in terms of returning their ballots. I used to work for the U.S. Postal Service when I was in college, and I understand that sometimes people's confidence, they can think of many bad experiences they personally had with the Postal Service. Being able to deliver a ballot before Election Day and not worrying that it was delayed, the post office will often tell you you need to make sure you mail your ballot a week before the election. That's kind of strange when you're thinking it's just going from the outskirts of Madison to downtown, but it's not the way they process that mail.
Hey, Kevin, thanks so much for joining us today. Really appreciate it.
Happy to do it.
Kevin Kennedy was Wisconsin's chief election official for more than 30 years and currently sits on the board of the Center for Election Innovation and Research, taking a look today about what contributes to the speed of vote counting that we see in Wisconsin, Florida, Arizona, across the board. Coming up Monday on Central Time, Rob's back, and if you're having trouble unplugging, then find out about the new course being taught at Lawrence University. It's called Doing Nothing, and we'll show you how it's done. This is Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret today, and you're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up on this week's edition of Food Friday, we're traveling to the Mediterranean Basin. Join us for a conversation with the author of the new cookbook, The Mediterranean Dish. First, food allergies have increased drastically in children in the last few decades. Check this out, 50% since the 1990s, according to the CDC. And research also indicates that food allergies are much more prevalent among adults than previously thought, including adult-onset food allergies. One study found that 11% of U.S. adults had a confirmed food allergy and 20% suspected they had a food allergy. Nearly half of the respondents said they'd acquired at least one food allergy in adulthood. So we're talking about why food allergies have become so much more prevalent in children and are fairly common in adults. And want to hear what you think as well at 1-800-642-1234. Do you or your children have food allergies? And what's the experience been like for you? Did you develop food allergies as an adult? Join us, 800-642-1234. And what are some of the terrors you've experienced as a parent? You can always email us, ideas@wpr.org, anytime. And our guest is Dr. Mark Moss, director of the Clinical Research Program in the Division of Allergy and Immunology at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. And Dr. Moss, welcome to Central Time.
Good afternoon.
And from your experience in your practice, just how much have allergies increased among kids in the last few decades?
There's definitely been an increase in food allergies, and I can personally describe how that's been seen in my practice. When I think back to when I was training a couple decades ago, there were relatively smaller numbers of children with food allergies, and that number has just steadily increased over time. Another practical way to think of it is for a lot of people that are now adults and may have children themselves, is when they think back to being in school and being school age, there weren't a lot of other children that they remember having food allergies. Maybe you know the rare situation where someone maybe in their class or another class had a food allergy, and now it's not uncommon for at least one child or maybe even two or more to have a food allergy in any given elementary school class.
And do we know whether more babies are being born with food allergies or whether more infants are developing them after birth?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it's important to remember that people in general are not born with allergies. So okay. When we're born, we may have a risk of developing allergy as we get older, but we aren't born with allergies. And that's for food allergy and for environmental allergies as well. But as we grow, as infants develop and get older, the chance of developing allergic diseases increases. And often that's initially seen with a skin condition called eczema or atopic dermatitis, which is a dry, red, itchy skin condition that many infants have. But in children that are prone to have allergy can be much more prevalent. And then as children grow older, that's when they develop allergies at various ages throughout their lifetime.
So then what about adults, Dr. Moss? Have food allergies actually increased among adults, or do we just not know enough about food allergies in adulthood?
Another really good question. So we have to be a little careful in adults. Most of there really have not been a lot of extensive studies looking at food allergy in adults. And it's an area that is one that is ripe for further investigation. The challenge with a lot of studies that are done with adults is that they're done by phone or questionnaire. And so the question of whether someone has a food allergy is directed to the individual, the person. And they may or may not know whether they have an allergy, but they know that when they eat something, they may not feel good. And as a result, a lot of people will label that as being an allergy, when in fact it could be a host of other food-related conditions. And as a result, you sometimes get an overestimate in adults of the number of people that have a true food allergy.
Dr. Moss, is part of this increase in allergy, food allergies among children, an improvement in diagnoses?
Another good question. So, diagnostics for food allergy have definitely advanced over the last few decades. In general, the ways that food allergies are diagnosed have been very good over time. So this is something that's likely not due to greater diagnosis or recognition as as in some conditions it can be. But rather, there's something that is changing. And when we see a change that occurs this rapidly in time, it tends to be something that we have to think of as being environmental or something external to people that's driving this change.
Dr. Mark Moss, our guest, director of the Clinical Research Program in the Division of Allergy and Immunology at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, taking a look at the rise of food allergies among children and getting your reaction at 1-800-642-1234, where Dennison Terrivers is standing by. Dennis, good afternoon. You're on the air with Dr. Mark Moss.
Hi. I was surprised when I heard a bite from a Lone Star tick can cause an allergy to meat. I thought, well, allergy, I thought that would be something somebody would have genetically. So I just wonder, well, what other bites or exposures in the environment might make us susceptible to allergies? I'll hang up and listen.
Dennis, I appreciate that. I've heard the story, too, that there is this tick, the Lone Star tick, and it could cause a meat allergy. Dr. Moss?
Yeah, that's right. This is something that's definitely been recognized more recently. And what occurs is a susceptible individual, if they're bitten by the Lone Star tick, it'll elicit an immune response that then causes a person to generate something called IgE, which is an immune globulin that's important in allergy, directed against red meat. And typically this would be beef and pork. And then subsequently, when a person eats one of these foods, they may develop a reaction. And it's somewhat of an unusual food allergy. Usually food allergy is something that occurs very quickly, within minutes of eating the food. But with this Lone Star tick bite associated reaction, it's an IgE that reaction that's directed against some of the carbohydrates in the meat. And it's a much more delayed reaction. It occurs hours later. So often people will eat dinner, go to bed feeling fine, and then wake up 6 hours later with flushing and vomiting and feeling poorly. So it's a good example of an understanding of, again, a not typical food allergy, but definitely a reaction that's been appreciated in recent years.
And Dennis asks, are there other bites that or other insects, other external elements that could cause mm-hmm. these allergies?
Yeah, so this is one of the best described situations. So we don't know. We don't know if there's other bites or insect interactions that might drive this. We do know that there are some relationships between another bug, if you will, which are called dust mites. Dust mites are a very common cause of allergy. They're microscopic members of the spider family that live in bedding. And they share a lot of similar allergens to shrimp and other shellfish. So that's an association between an insect or a bug and a food that we sometimes see and is being appreciated in a much better way, that people that have underlying allergy to dust mite, again, a fairly common allergy, may, as they get older, develop reactions when they eat shellfish such as shrimp.
What's the prevalence of Lone Star tick bites versus dust mite allergens in Wisconsin, Dr. Moss?
It's a night and day. So okay. You know, very, very few people have Lone Star tick bites. Fortunately, they're not really indigenous to the area. They're more in southern areas. So we do see some people here, usually who've moved from the south and have moved from the east. It's a very, very rare condition. I've only seen it once or twice in my practice. But other places in the country, you see it more frequently. Dust mite allergy, on the other hand, is very frequent. It's actually one of the most common airborne allergens that people are allergic to and can affect as many as 40% of people that have allergic rhinitis or nasal allergies.
Yeah, would there be any connection to potentially from dust mites to food allergies?
So the only one that we really know well is this a similar homology between the allergens for dust mites and shrimp. And okay. And even that is it's a very small number of people. So most people that are allergic to dust mites have no trouble if they eat shellfish.
We're talking about food allergies and why they've been on the rise among children and adults in recent years. Our guest is Dr. Mark Moss, director of the Clinical Research Program in the Division of Allergy and Immunology at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. And join us, 800-642-1234. How did you expose your children to some of the common allergens like peanuts, eggs, and soy? And if you had a child with food allergies, how do you navigate school and other places where they might be exposed? What questions do you have for our allergist expert? Call us, 1-800-642-1234. Email us, ideas@WPR.org. Our conversation continues next on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, in for Rob Ferret. And right now, we're picking up our conversation about food allergies with Dr. Mark Moss. He directs the Clinical Research Program in the Division of Allergy and Immunology at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Give out the number for you to join us at any time at 1-800-642-1234 with your questions. That's 800-642-1234. And Dr. Moss, the question I have for you are, what are some of the hypotheses for why we've seen these food allergies increase among children in such a short span of time? What are some of the scientific things that we're thinking of?
Yeah, so the best theory is something called the hygiene hypothesis, which involves the concept that over time, people have been exposed to different amounts of things in the environment, specifically bacteria and fungal products that we were exposed to much more frequently when we all grew up in more rural areas, on farms, not in big cities or suburbia. And over time, this has changed significantly with people moving to more urban areas. And as a result, people and children and young children are not exposed to these bacterial products. For example, on a farm, you have animals, large animals that have a lot of waste that carries bacteria. And while we think of this as, you know, being something you want to avoid, there may actually be something beneficial to the bacteria people are exposed to in these environments. And a couple of my colleagues here at the UW, I have a large group of infants and now young children that they follow, born on farms and in nearby cities or towns, trying to identify what is the, if you will, the ingredient, the magic or beneficial ingredient on the farm that helps to shift someone's immune system from becoming allergic to remaining non-allergic. And if we can figure that out, our hope is that with time, we may be able to introduce children or infants to these bacterial products at a very young age that may be beneficial in the prevention of development of allergies.
Let's go back to your questions now for our guest, Dr. Mark Moss, at 1-800-642-1234. We're Dee and McFarland standing by. Dee, you're on Central Time.
Hey there. Question for you about the possibility of food allergies being passed down through the family. Basically, in my family, we have a lot of seasonal allergies. And do those relate to food allergies?
And could you say a lot of what type of allergies?
You know, like seasonal, they used to call it hay fever.
Yeah, seasonal.
But now I've got grandsons who have food allergies.
Sure. Your situation is actually one I see every day in clinic where parents, grandparents may have had seasonal allergies, but now children or grandchildren are developing food allergies. And this gets at that concept that people, again, aren't born with food allergies, but they're born with this genetic predisposition to have allergy, something called atopy. And when they are born, they may or may not encounter some of these external factors that may shift them from being more likely to be allergic to rather than be less likely to be allergic. So that's one of the common situations we hear where the children that are born with food allergies, not born, but develop food allergies, are born to parents that have a history of allergy. And it may be something as simple as hay fever.
Let's continue with your questions for our guest, Dr. Mark Moss. We'll go to Janet next, who's in Spring Green. Good afternoon, Janet.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you. What do you have for us?
My comment is that up until sometime in the 80s, we fed infants formula for the first 4 to 6 months. But when they were doing well, we would introduce cereal and fruits and some vegetables. And then at 6 months, we basically put them on solid foods. I know there are several countries in Africa where newborns are given honey and ground peanuts, and virtually there's no peanut allergies in those countries. Do you think that the trend towards formula for the first year has brought about some of these problems?
A number of different aspects there, Janet. Thank you. Dr. Moss?
Yeah, you've got a lot of important questions embedded in your question. And we know that breastfeeding is very good for infants and encourage it greatly. And there do seem to be benefits in breast milk. We do see a variety of different obviously beneficial substances and see food that the mother eats can be transmitted in breast milk, or the proteins of these allergens of these foods can be transmitted. So there can be some benefits to breastfeeding. But the other question, or the other part of the question, had to do with some of the early introduction of solid foods. And this is a newer concept that we are now seeing, where about 5-6 years ago, there was a study done in Great Britain that looked at children and why there were more children in Great Britain who had food allergy to peanut versus other parts of the country like Israel, where children with food allergy are fairly low in number. And the big difference was that in Israel, kids were fed peanut in the form of these puffs with peanut protein very early in life, before a year of age. Subsequent studies showed that that introduction of peanut in the right children, so children, again, who are at risk of developing allergy, not just the average person that's never going to develop allergies no matter what you do, but the children at risk for developing allergy, if they're given peanut early on, that you can potentially shift their immune system from becoming allergic to peanut to not being allergic to peanut. And this is a study that's called the LEAP study, and it was really revolutionary in our understanding of some of the parts of the development of food allergy to peanut. Now, a lot of people would try to extrapolate that to other foods, and we're not quite there yet. But a couple of my colleagues, Dr. Anne-Marie Singh, Dr. Jim Gern here at the university, have two birth cohort studies that are recruiting mothers who are pregnant to enroll their infants in this these two studies, looking at really what puts kids at risk of developing allergy in the first place. And that's going to really expand our understanding of what risk factors may be present very, very early on in life, and hopefully answer some of the questions in your multifaceted question.
Let's continue with your questions now. We'll go to Dan in Lone Rock next. Dan, you're on the air with Dr. Mark Moss, Director of the Clinical Research Program in the Division of Allergy and Immunology at UW Health.
Yeah, hey, I kind of a couple of questions in one, but I've heard that, especially with grain allergies, people explain it in relation to the, you know, increased herbicides and pesticides that are on our crops and then therefore kind of in our food. But my brain also jumps to the, you know, the we've got a lot more synthetic additives and packaging. And I'm just wondering what you're finding out about those relationships and causation for food allergies.
Yeah, Dan, thank you. Pesticides, herbicides, packaging, wrapping, all the plastics. Dr. Moss?
Yeah, so a lot of that we don't have a great understanding about, but certainly a lot of those factors change some of the makeup of bacterial products in foods. And that may be part of what may be driving some of this. Again, the old saying that a little bit of dirt early on or a little bit of bacteria early on is probably beneficial for you. That's, again, a very big change that we've seen environmentally in the way we live in the last few years. So more to probably come on that as we are able to delve deeper into some of these early onset causes of allergy in general.
Dr. Moss, are there certain populations that are more susceptible to this trend of increased food allergies among children, socioeconomic, race? Is there a breakdown that you can find?
Yeah, one of the biggest factors that seems to make a difference is again, we talked about genetics with the earlier caller's question. And so people that are genetically at risk, so having family members that are allergic puts individuals at a greater chance to develop allergy themselves. And then early development of eczema or atopic dermatitis, where the skin is somewhat susceptible, may be one of the causes that, or one of the associations that seems to put children at risk. So there's a lot of factors that go into this, which again is why it's important to try to look at children from an early age before they have allergy, and then to help determine what is going on with their own bacteria, their microbiome in their stool, their secretions in their nose, the integrity of their skin. And all of these are things that are being looked at in a couple of the studies I mentioned earlier.
Dr. Moss, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me on the program.
You bet. Dr. Moss, Director of the Clinical Research Program in the Division of Allergy and Immunology at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Coming up after the news, it's Food Friday, and we take you to the Mediterranean with the author of the new cookbook, The Mediterranean Dish. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.